The Theosophical Society presents Mr. N. Sri Ram in a talk entitled The Beauty of Virtue.
There are certain words in the English language the meaning of which is only partially known. I'm sure there are similar words in other languages too. The meaning is only partially known because it has to be discovered not through the words of another, but through life and action. Wisdom is such a word. We may have a certain concept of it, but I am sure that in the case of everyone, practically, the concept is partial, lacking in depth. We do not really know what wisdom means. We don't know its true quality, its beauty, its action. We do not know it. We have some vague, imperfect, sketchy idea of what this word wisdom means. And there are other words. Now, virtue is such a word. Sometimes we use the singular form, virtue, to cover everything of that nature. But sometimes we speak of the virtues in the plural. One virtue is this, and the other is truth, and the third is something else, and so forth. And these virtues have been classified in various ways. For instance, it might be interesting just to mention casually one or two of these classifications. In Greek thought, the justice, temperance or moderation, courage and prudence, these were regarded as the cardinal virtues. Justice, temperance or moderation, courage and prudence. But when you look at these virtues, you can see that they can become very superficial. Prudence might merely mean, it may not be even a virtue at all. It might really become acting according to the exigencies of the situation. You do what is prudent to save your skin, or what is prudent in certain contingencies that you anticipate. It might easily become a manifestation or form of self-interest. But it may be that when they use these four words, they are only English translations. They may not even be correct. Perhaps they understood it in a deeper sense. Perhaps. I do not know. I have not studied these Greek classics and so on. I don't know Greek at all. Greek is Greek to me. Now, these virtues, prudence, courage and so on, they are virtues that belong to the realm of reason. Any reasonable person might think out, well, I think there ought to be a certain degree of courage in any situation and so forth. But when the Christian influence spread in Europe, other virtues of a predominantly unworldly nature, they gradually assumed precedence. Such virtues as humility, faith, charity or love, these were considered the most important, nearest, so to say, to the divine nature. Now, in Mahayana Buddhism, which is the northern school of Buddhism, there are the seven portals. Each portal signifies a virtue. And these seven portals are enumerated and explained in Voice of the Silence, the last of the three fragments. I will just mention them because it's an exceedingly interesting series. The first portal is Dana. They are all Sanskrit names. Dana means giving. And I think HPB translates it as boundless charity, love immortal, giving with one's heart, not merely with one's hand. That is Dana. It is the first portal to be passed on the path of occultism, the path to the summit of human attainment. One has to begin with that. And the altruistic spirit. Second is Sheila. Sheila is translated by her as harmony in thought and conduct. That is perfect behavior. You just do the right thing with regard to every question, every situation, in every context. Sheila. And the third is Shanti. Shanti means patience. Patience sweet which naught can ruffle. These are the words in that book. Beautifully expressed. Patience sweet which naught means nothing of course can ruffle. And the fourth is Vairagya. Translated as indifference to pleasure and pain. That is, it has also been translated as passionlessness, which doesn't mean bloodlessness, a kind of moral and spiritual anemia. It doesn't mean that. It means that you don't get involved in things so that the things begin to work you. Instead of you managing the things to which you become attached, they manage you and determine your conduct. So it is detachment. That is Vairagya. And the next one is Virya, which is dauntless energy. It is not mechanical energy. It is the energy of the spiritual intelligence. And the spiritual will, it is different from the mere brute energy, let us say that you find in the atomic nucleus, any energy of that sort, mechanical energy. And then two other portals, they are named Dhyana. Dhyana is contemplation. And Prajna. Prajna means comprehension, perfect comprehension. But these last two are really conditions of being. You cannot call them virtues. Dhyana is a condition, is a state of being. Meditation, you may call it. Inward meditation. And prajna is comprehension. And these two conditions can include any or all the virtues. Now, let us consider what is our concept of virtue? When we say virtue, I am using the singular form to cover all the virtues. What is our concept? Generally, we regard it as a precept or a principle to which one has to conform in conduct. You have a certain idea of how you should act. The idea is there. And you try to approximate your conduct to that concept or idea. You try all the time to keep as close to the ideal as possible. But in doing so, there is always a certain gap between the ideal and the actual. The ideal is to be absolutely truthful without any pretense. Any kind of deception, conscious or unconscious. But it is extremely difficult to be so absolutely truthful in one's nature, not merely in word, in conduct, in thought. The whole nature has to become a nature of truth. That is what is meant by being truthful. It's extremely difficult, as you can see. And when there is this gap between the ideal and the actual, there is always dissatisfaction. You feel dissatisfied with yourself. And when you feel dissatisfied with yourself, you will psychologically transfer it to the ideal. You will become dissatisfied with the ideal. Because you are unable to carry out the ideal, therefore you say, why? Why this ideal? After all, is it so necessary? Perhaps it is not the thing to follow. So there is the questioning of the ideal and even a revolt against it. And that is the danger in placing an ideal which is beyond the reach of people. There is value in it. The mere contemplation of the ideal has great value. But when you are unable to carry it out, you feel dissatisfied. You want to let it go and you will act just as it comes to you, as you please. Let us say the ideal is to abstain from every kind of spirituous liquor. Spirituous, not spiritual. There is no spiritual liquor. Now, you are unable to do it. Then you begin to question this idea of teetotalism. Why this? Is it necessary? Perhaps man is intended to indulge himself a little bit. Life is easier, sweeter, smoother. It conduces to good relationship and so on and so forth. But virtue can be regarded in another light. That is, as a natural expression of the pure basic nature of man. When you come to that rock bottom, the basic nature, it is still uncorrupted because it is not so much in touch with the world. Therefore, the world has not had time to modify and alter it, to mold it according to its own ideas. And that pure being or nature can express itself naturally in its own way. And that may be the true way of virtue. I am sure that the great Chinese teacher Lao Tse will agree with this standpoint. This is what he really speaks of in his famous classic. But it needs insight to perceive this fact. It's not a question of somebody saying, but do you see it like that? Do you see that there is the possibility of a certain nature in man which can spontaneously express itself in forms which constitute virtue, and that is virtue. It's the most natural form of action. It flows easily because it's an expression of your own deepest, innate, uncorrupted instinct. Therefore, you are most natural when you are virtuous. And you are virtuous without any effort, spontaneously, not by will, not by deliberation, not by much thought, not by much practice. You don't need any class to teach you virtue. But one has to see that there can be such a nature. After all, this insight is necessary. That is really what we should come to as the first step. We are all of us not yet even at the first step. We are coming to the first step. You know, there is the noble eightfold path of the Buddha. Right insight, right thought, right speech, right action, right means of livelihood and so forth. And the very first step, if you call it step, because it's not one after the other, you have to take them all together. Well, it is right insight, usually translated as right belief, which is a wrong translation. That is the translation of the Orientalists. They don't know Sanskrit. They have dictionaries, but the dictionary meaning is so often wrong. The Sanskrit word is drishti, which means sight, vision, insight. That's what it means. It's not belief. So it needs insight to perceive the essential truths. You do not come to the essence of truth by any kind of thought, not by any kind of labor, but you open your eyes, your inner eyes, and you see. And then you see the essence of the truth, the soul of truth, not the form of truth. So one needs insight. And all that we discuss and so on is a kind of approach to that point, which I spoke of yesterday as an awakening. Whether you use the word awakening or insight, it means the same. And in amongst Buddhists, they also speak of it in another phrase, opening the doors of the mind. The mind is closed, except for a little window. It's that kind of prison where there is a small grill at the top through which a little air and light is let in. Otherwise, the prison is confined and dark. Many of us, or the vast majority of mankind, are really in that kind of prison, really speaking. The prison is self-created. But to throw open all the windows and the doors, then you are able to see. Now, virtue, so it may be the spontaneous expression of a state of being which is in all of us as a potentiality or deep down in us. And when that nature or state of being comes into action, it expresses itself in the most natural manner possible as virtue in every form. Virtue is always in action. If there is without action, there is no virtue at all. And this action, it errs neither by excess nor by defect, neither by going too far nor by falling short. In that sense, the word temperance or moderation, I think, is quite right. It is what the Greeks sometimes call the golden mean. The golden mean doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean a kind of compromise. It doesn't mean you can have a little bit of this, but also a little bit of that. It's a kind of pleasant mixture of what one wants and what one ought to do. It's not that. The golden mean is perfect balance, an inner poise which nothing can upset. That is the golden mean. But I am not going to talk on that golden mean. It is like a line drawn by a perfect artist. You know, he draws a curve of beauty. It must just be there. You can't alter it. Put it a little nearer or put it a little further away. You can't do it because he knows exactly through what points that line or curve must pass. There is that infallible instinct which tells him precisely where it should be. And that is the way virtue works. In conduct, you know just how to behave. You don't go too far, you don't fall short. It's a beautiful idea, is it not? Or true. And in virtue, the manner of action is as important as the concrete result. Nowadays, we all think of what results he has produced. But the way in which the result is produced is as important, or perhaps even more important than the concrete result, because the manner expresses the feeling with which the thing is done. It radiates a certain quality. When there is action, there are vibrations, but these vibrations are ordered in a certain way by the manner of doing a thing. the manner is like the inflection of the voice when a person sings. When you sing, the way in which you proceed from one note to another, the way in which the voice is inflected from one second to the next is important, is it not? Otherwise you don't produce music. So the way in which you act at every point of the action, at every moment during which the action takes place, that really constitutes the manner of the action. Therefore, the manner cannot be separated from the result which is deposited, so to say, in a concrete form. All virtues are really forms assumed by a certain energy in oneself. It's that energy, the energy of one's nature, it acts. When the energy acts or moves, it creates a certain pattern. All action is always in a certain pattern. When we say pattern, we always think it is a set pattern which one has to copy or follow. It doesn't follow. The pattern may be created by the energy according to its own nature or quality. So when we say pattern, we can't say in what shop is it to be obtained and how many patterns are there. That is not the way. When the energy acts, it creates the pattern. So that means it creates a certain form. And the form which is assumed by that energy, it's a form of action. And that is virtue. The energy of what? Not the energy of our nature as it is. Because this nature is one which has been artificially created. It's a nature which is a form of conditioning. We have been conditioned to think in certain ways, feel in certain ways, react, act in particular ways. You are an American, you think in certain ways, I think in some other way, because I've been brought up like that in India. So we are all conditioned. Our whole thinking is conditioned thinking. You think according to the society, according to the church, to the newspaper, to the radio, to the education you have received, the books you have read, and all that. So that we rarely think in absolute freedom, with complete objectivity, without any kind of leaning to this side or that. But there is in the possibility of becoming completely free of condition, so that you are neither a Hindu, nor a Christian, nor a Buddhist, nor anything else. You are just yourself. You are neither an American, nor a Russian, nor a Chinese, nor an Indian. You are just a human being, so that you put on no label. You are plastered with no kind of title or description. That is the unconditioned nature. It's a nature which is in a state of absolute purity. It is in its original condition, not tampered with, not molded, not modified, not indoctrinated, not transformed into some kind of a mechanism which works in a particular way. So there is the possibility of completely deconditioning ourselves. And that, I think, is a wonderful possibility. It is a truth of the most extraordinary significance. When you say Mahatma, adept, liberated being, liberated from what? From every kind of conditioning, not merely from karma. The karma results from conditioned action. When there is no conditioning, then no karma is created. So that is the unconditioned nature, which is present in everyone. And that nature acts spontaneously. No will is involved. The person doesn't say, I now must act according to the unconditioned nature, which is all absurd, it is so artificial. when she says, I must now act, it means the mind which makes the determination, and that mind itself is a product of conditioning, and then it says it's going to act according to the unconditioned being which it imagines according to its own conditioning. So it's a completely distorted statement. It makes no sense at all. No, there is that unconditioned nature. It acts by itself in its own way. No I comes in there at all. So there is no will which comes in and says, you act according to this image. I will give you a diagram, a rule, a precept, a principle. No, you make up your mind. You always act, always keep looking at it and then act according to it. No. There is no such will, no such conformity at all in the action of that free or unconditioned nature. It's a nature of freedom. It's freedom itself. When you say will, why do you will something and not something else? This is my will. I will to do so. Why do you say I will? We think that will is something very superior. It is spiritual, we think. Is it so spiritual? There may be a spiritual will, but we leave that alone. We don't know anything about it. Will as we know it is very often mere obstinacy. It is just stupidity. It's persistence in one's own idea. The refusal to give up one's stand. It's really a form of egoism. You want to stand your ground against the other person. Surely. But why does one will this and not that? Because it suits him. The will in reality is desire. It arises from one's conditioning, from one's inclinations. That is what we call will. Therefore, this will is just the kind of brute assertion. It is the exertion of a certain energy which comes from the way in which the individual has been conditioned. So there is no will involved in the action of this unconditioned nature. The energy that springs from conditioning is mechanical. But the energy of the spiritual nature, which is the unconditioned nature, is quite different in action. It acts freely and intelligently, always intelligently. This energy acts, and as I said a little while ago, in doing so it creates a pattern or a form, and this form will change according to circumstances. But the action of this unconditioned nature arises from a basis of sensitivity and life. From what basis does it arise? What is it which is unconditioned? We say it is a nature. Well, if it is unconditioned, what are the attributes of that nature? One of the attributes is it's extremely sensitive. So from a basis of sensitivity and life, which is full of energy, there arises this action. And the form which that action takes is the most natural action possible, and that is virtuous action. This is quite a different view of virtue from what we perhaps have had so far. Cultivated virtue, that is, virtue which arises from conformity to a certain image in the mind, is very different from spontaneous action that is just right, that is just virtuous. You act spontaneously, without any kind of dictation, without any kind of willing, with ease, in the most natural manner. And that is just right, it is just virtuous. Hasn't that got a charm, a beauty, which doesn't belong to anything which is artificially practiced, cultivated, which is labored? And there is the possibility of such action. Because when the ground of one's nature is clear, when it has been made into virgin soil, absolutely pure, the whole nature, when it is immaculate, then the divine seed which is there, present there, will flower of its own accord. And this divine seed, the word seed is used in Sanskrit. Well, it is present in every form of life, but it may flower or it may not flower. Some seeds may fall into sterile soil and may not grow at all, but the seed is there all the same. In other words, the divine principle, the spiritual principle, is present everywhere in nature. And it will, when the ground is absolutely clear, immaculate, pure, then it will come to flower of its own accord. Why? Because it is a concentration of energies. Seed is just a word which we use. What does this seed mean? Is there something like the seed that we see, the seeds of so many trees? It's a concentration of energies. Naturally, the energy will act. But the energies which are concentrated act always in a form of harmony. And that is why it is the divine seed. It's full of potentiality, of virility. And all beautiful virtues spring from the same soil of an uncorrupt, immaculate nature. And this is what they say when they say that Christ was born out of Virgin Mary. She was the embodiment of purity, and there was no father, and he was born straight from her. Well, that is a kind of anthropomorphic way of expressing this truth. There is the possibility of an immaculateness within ourselves, purity, freedom from every kind of compulsion and conditioning. And from that soil, there arises a certain growth, certain flower. Which flower is the Christ, or you can use any other name you like. And the divine seed will flower only in such a soil, the soil of purity. And that seed, as I said, is a concentration of energies. But when the energies flow out, they always will act in a form of harmony and in no other way. Let us say when there are 12 forces all concentrated and you release them, each force proceeds in its own way, naturally, easily, but then they can act in the most uncoordinated manner. So they may be produced a certain discord, conflict, but not that. There is always the harmony. But the form may differ according to circumstances, conditions, exigencies, contexts. But all these forms of harmony in behavior, in conduct, will agree with one another. They will all be in harmony also with one another. In fact, all virtues really constitute a unity. All virtues are one virtue. That is what Socrates said in one of his dialogues. They are really aspects of one virtue. That is, forms assumed by the energy which springs from that unconditioned nature. Or to put it in another way, there is an instinct of virtue or rightness in man. That instinct is suppressed. It doesn't exist at present. You cannot say there cannot be such an instinct. You see in nature, birds and animals display instincts in different forms, which are really wonderful and have never been properly explained. The usual explanation is that the instinct grows out of previous experience. But I don't know whether that explanation is correct at all. It may be correct to some extent, but not altogether. But there is, well, whether that is true or not, in man there is an instinct of virtue, just as there is an instinct of beauty. The perfect artist, he knows what is beautiful, what is not beautiful. And in the same way, he knows just what is right, what is the moral thing, what is the virtuous thing to do. And when we say beauty, it is really inner beauty, not exoteric beauty. Beauty of soul, beauty which is in mind and heart, which is much more wonderful than any kind of external beauty. A certain writer said that all arts aspire towards music. They are trying to come to that form which belongs to perfect music. If you think of architecture, if you think of sculpture, you see there is not that flexibility which is in music. And therefore, music can be a more perfect creation than any other creation in material which is less plastic than sound. Therefore, all arts in their perfection seek to approximate to music. Now similarly one might say that all external beauty is really an attempt to approximate to the beauty of soul, the beauty that is inside oneself, beauty of mind and heart. There is nothing which is comparable to it. And this inner beauty, if when it is there, when it is present, when it is manifesting itself, it constantly translates itself into life and action. Always it is translated into life. It doesn't stay there as a beauty which you enjoy. It's not a matter for enjoyment, but it is a beauty in action. Therefore it is translated. When I say into life and action, it means into thought, into feeling. Action doesn't mean only action with hands and legs or lips. It doesn't mean that. It can be action at various levels in different forms. So this inner beauty, the beauty of soul, of one's pure being, it is always in action. It constantly translates itself into beauty of feeling, into beauty of thought. And that is virtue. That is why I took as my title the beauty of virtue. The virtue is really the beauty of the soul. There is no real distinction to be made between virtue, which is exemplified in conduct, and the beauty of one's inner nature, from which the virtue springs spontaneously and naturally. A fundamental distinction to be made in virtues is between those virtues which may be called basic or spiritual and those which are secondary, which are really the secondary effects of spiritual realization. The basic virtues are such virtues as humility, innocence, purity of heart, love, and there are others. There are others which cannot even be named. But there are secondary effects or corollaries which follow from those virtues which constitute the basic principles. For instance, let us say, which commend themselves to reason, freedom from laziness, people would say, well, that is a virtue, he is not lazy. Not being lazy is a virtue. But it is a secondary virtue. You may not be lazy, you may be energetic, but you may be doing more harm than good by your energy. So it is not enough to be not lazy. It all depends upon how you act. We may say perseverance. One can persevere in wrongheadedness. You set your mind on something and then you go on. Sure, these are virtues, no doubt. Efficiency and so forth. But they are secondary. That is to say, when you realize certain things within yourself, you understand you should not give way to laziness. You should act when action is needed. That realization comes to you. And out of that realization, you begin to act according to the need of the situation. So you are not lazy. You gain freedom from laziness out of an inner realization. Not just because people say you are a lazy fellow and that is a contemptuous description. Well, I am a lazy fellow but somebody else is a mischievous fellow, so that I don't know which is to be preferred. When you really consider what is laziness, I won't go into that question now. You will see that for real freedom, you have to be free from laziness. Laziness fixes you. It keeps you stuck. It inhibits you. It prevents action when action is needed. So life becomes dull, stale, entrenched, fixed when a person is lazy. When he realizes this, he will cease to be lazy. So it's not a question of people saying that laziness is bad. If somebody says this is bad, I should say, don't accept it. You consider it for yourself. Is it bad or is it good? Don't accept any opinion given by anybody. He may be a highly intellectual person, or it may be a large number of people. The society around you may say something, but I don't think it's necessary for a really intelligent person who wants to be free in every way, inside himself, to accept what comes to him from outside. And this was the teaching of the Buddha. You know, he said, do not accept a thing because it has come down from a great antiquity, because it is in a book which people call sacred, because it comes from a teacher who is revered. Do not accept it even if I say it. But consider it for yourself, and if it commends itself to you, then you accept it and act upon it. There could not be better advice given by a great spiritual teacher than that. But people quote this kind of thing, but they act differently. You know, when the occasion suits them, they will say the Buddha said that. But they don't take it to heart. They don't act according to that here and now. They don't do that. But we should do that. That beauty which belongs to one's inner being, the being which is uncorrupted, manifests itself in one's mind and heart when it is truly selfless. It will manifest itself. You don't seek to acquire that beauty. You cannot do it. It cannot be acquired. Cannot be practiced. It cannot be cultivated. You can't even have an image of it in your mind. But when you are truly selfless, the beauty will manifest itself. It is easy to imagine that one is selfless, especially when he is working for a cause to which he is devoted. You see, I am working all the time, 24 hours of the day, selflessly, for the Theosophical Society. I have done it for the last 60 years. How selfless I am. But the self is not so easily extirpated. I might have been working all the time for self. Who knows? I might be doing that even now. It needs great awareness and understanding to see through the action of the self, how far it is present inside your heart. It is like a concealed serpent. It emits poison all the time. The poison spreads through your actions, through your whole being, and it is not so easily discovered and extirpated. But still, if you want to see through it, you can see through it. Even when the self is not present, as an active entity thrusting its presence, I want this, I must gain that, I want this for myself. Even when it is not there, it can operate in a very indirect manner. It can spread itself through the whole being. When all that the word self connotes, it includes aggrandizement, aggression, on the other hand, self-pity, and so forth. I won't mention the whole brood. When all that is gone, then there is purity, innocence, and all the other basic qualities of the soul constituting its luster. The qualities will come. When the weaknesses disappear, the qualities will appear by themselves. And the extraordinary thing is that if one of these qualities is attained in perfection, all will follow. Each involves the others. For every quality arises from that condition of being. And when you come to that condition of being, all qualities are present there. All virtues are present there. Because it is the source of all virtues. So one need not cultivate these virtues one after the other. In fact, virtue in its spiritual quality, not as a form of action which has been taught to a person and is being practiced by him, but in its spiritual quality, it cannot be cultivated. It has to appear by itself. There are certain graces, certain virtues, certain truths which must appear by themselves. You cannot go after them and find them. You cannot lay your hands upon them. They are too pure, too beautiful for us to clutch them. They cannot be clutched. So virtue is not knowledge. Knowledge can be taught. If I know certain things, I can say them to you and you learn them. But virtue cannot be taught. It has to come by itself. Knowledge consists of various concepts which can be pictured, which can be copied, but a virtue which is an expression of the purity or the beauty of one's being, it really cannot be taught at all. So one might say, then how is this virtue to be communicated? How do you communicate a feeling? You have a certain feeling. It is inexpressible in words. A feeling for beauty, a feeling for a person, a feeling of love. It is inexpressible. How are you to communicate it to another? How do you teach another good taste? It is something which cannot be taught. These are in a different category from knowledge. Yet, you can communicate it through affection or love. That is possible. When there is love for another, in some inner way, you can communicate that quality which is in your heart to that person. Not in so many words, but it can be communicated. And that is also quite an extraordinary fact. When there is a child, how does the child learn so many things? Good taste, good feeling, the way to act, the way to speak, a feeling of reverence, a feeling of affection. All this the child learns, not through the words spoken by the mother, but somehow the mother conveys it from her own heart to the heart of the child, because the child is attuned to the mother. So when there is that attunement, then you can communicate what is inside you to the other person. Virtue really belongs, although I said mind and heart, it belongs to heart and soul, not the mind. That nature of the heart, which is the soul. When we say heart, it sometimes can mean one's personal reactions. You know, we say, it is a... I act according to what comes within my heart. It can be just a personal reaction. And we often use the word heart to indicate the nature of those reactions. But that is not the heart. The word heart has a different meaning. That is, that nature of the heart, which is the soul, which is not a reaction of the separated self. No personal reaction at all. It's pure affection, it is pure love, totally selfless, which is capable of a million feelings. We think that a person can have a million ideas, but we have no inkling of the truth that there is the possibility of a million feelings within oneself. The heart has a spectrum as extensive, as far-ranging as the mind of man. But we have not come to that point yet. I use the word spectrum. You might say there are the strings of the heart out of which endless music can be produced. But we have little knowledge of what that music can be. In other words, we use the word love. We do not know what love really means, what range it covers, what kind of feelings are included in it. So my virtue, all virtues are really one virtue. And virtue is really the beauty of the soul, spontaneously expressing itself in different forms of action. And all action of this nature is beautiful, whether it is word or speech or gesture or the mere look, whatever it may be. It is possible to translate this beauty into every little gesture, every little movement of one's being and personality. There is nothing more beautiful than virtue in that sense. All other beauty pales in comparison with the beauty that is within oneself, or that can be in oneself, that can manifest in oneself. And it is that beauty which really attracts all hearts. Yesterday I referred to Sri Krishna and said the word Krishna means he who attracts. How does he attract? He attracts by his beauty. What kind of beauty? Maybe the beauty of the personality. But really it means the beauty of the divine presence of the spiritual nature of oneself. Because he was so extraordinarily beautiful, the very embodiment of beauty, therefore he charmed and attracted all hearts which were susceptible, which were open to that beauty. Thank you.